Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 13, 2007. This is Doug Henwin. We're looking at the most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics, and got the usual two segments up for tonight. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Bart Jones, who is the author of a large but very fine new biography of Hugo Chavez. What's the subtitle? The Hugo Chavez Story from Mud Hut to Perpetual Revolution. Everything you want to know about Hugo Chavez right here in the cover, between the covers of this book. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear an interview I recorded the other day with Irvin Abrahamian, who is a professor of history at Baruch College, and although an ethnic Armenian, a native of Iran, and a great expert on that country. And we will talk to him about what has been going on in the internal politics of Iran. New head of the Council of Experts, Rafsanjani, and we'll ask just what that all means. And before we get to the first segment, a few words on recent goings-on in the economic world. Last Friday came the Bureau of Labor Statistics employment report for the month of August. It showed a decline of 4,000 jobs. That was the first negative jobs number since August 2003. While negative numbers are rare outside recessions, they're not unusual in the months leading up to recessions. So while the economy isn't falling apart yet, and there's nothing in this report that suggests that it is, it may be on the verge of a serious bout of rough weather. The negative numbers were concentrated in goods production, manufacturing, construction, and, rather unusually, government. Construction dropped 22,000, a clear symptom of the housing bust, and manufacturing a hefty 46,000. That sector's been weak for quite some time, but 46,000 is a big number, even by the recent standards of the bleeding of the manufacturing sector. Private services did add 88,000 jobs, though these were concentrated in two stars of this economic cycle, healthcare and bars and restaurants. Of course, healthcare's good news isn't necessarily good news for a lot of other sectors. It just keeps getting more and more expensive and more out of reach. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.6%, but to do this, it got a boost from the fact that the labor force contracted by 340,000 people. You have to be actively looking for work or actually employed to be counted as a member of the labor force. It's not clear why all these people dropped out, since the number who said they wanted a job now was essentially unchanged in the month. Maybe it's just short-term noise. We'll see what this looks like over the coming few months. In any case, the decline was a surprise to almost everyone who follows these things closely. So does it mean that the Federal Reserve is going to start cutting interest rates aggressively, perhaps as soon as next Tuesday's policy-setting meeting? Maybe, but maybe not. As I've noted here several times in recent weeks, the Fed and its colleagues around the world have been quite slow and grudging in their response to the financial crisis that began over the summer. Our Fed has been concerned about inflationary pressures, which basically means that the unemployment rate has gotten too low for their comfort, because that could push wages higher as workers increase their confidence and employers bid up for scarce skilled labor. So if it weren't for the financial panic, they might not even be thinking of cutting rates next Tuesday. My guess is that they'd like to see the unemployment rate creep up closer to 5% before they relax their vigilance. But doesn't the financial crisis change all that? Won't they do nearly anything to prevent things from getting out of hand like they did between 1929 and 1932? Yes, to some degree, but there seem to be limits. On Tuesday, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke gave a speech in Germany before a banking audience. Wall Street expected he'd talk about interest rates and the financial crisis, but he didn't. Instead, he gave a rather cerebral long-term analysis of what are called global imbalances, that is, the fact that the U.S. imports so much more than we export, and we borrow heavily abroad to finance all the buying. The orthodox cure for such a problem would be to engineer a recession, to bring the international accounts back into balance. That's what the IMF did to Mexico and Thailand in the 1990s. It may be that Bernanke was telegraphing his intention to let the crisis run on a bit, bring about the desired adjustment. That is, by not talking about the immediate crisis, but by talking about some of these longer-term concerns, he was actually sending a message to Wall Street, but Wall Street didn't seem like they were listening. That is, we have to consume less and save and invest more, which would be a big change for an economy that's been consuming its little heart out for decades. But there's another angle, too, and the Fed and some of its foreign counterparts are sounding as if they want to punish the speculators who got in over their heads and fancy incomprehensible mortgage securities in recent years. In the 1980s and 1990s, whenever financiers got themselves into trouble, Alan Greenspan was quick to bail them out. It may be that Bernanke wants to put an end to all that. Yesterday, Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, the UK's central bank, put out a very tough-sounding statement that made it clear that he doesn't want to bail out speculators once again. I don't recall any central banker saying anything like this since I've been following this stuff closely, which means for over 25 years. It is true that Wall Street likes to talk about discipline for others, but when they get into trouble, they're the first to look for a government bailout. The risk is, though, that the central banks get carried away with this disciplinary message and that the whole financial system implodes. Getting this right will require some very careful timing by the world's central bankers. We'll see if they're up to the task. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Bart Jones. And that was an excerpt from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 27 in E minor, a second movement performed by Alfred Brendel. And we're now joined on the line by Bart Jones, who is a Newsday reporter and the author of a very large but very compelling and excellent biography of Hugo Chavez, just out from Steerforth Press. Welcome to Behind the News, Bart Jones.
Thanks, Doug.
So, the mud hut. Let's start at the beginning. Hugo Chavez really born in a mud hut?
He really was, Doug. Chavez really grew up in, quite extensive poverty in Venezuela. There were very few doctors or nurses in the area of the Great Plains where he was born. So he was delivered by a midwife in the living room, so to speak, of his grandmother's mud hut, and actually spent the first several years of his life living there.
His way out was through the military academy, right?
Well, that's right. As a boy, he really dreamed of becoming a Major League Baseball player. And the only way he figured he could make it to the big leagues was by getting discovered as a baseball player. And he was a left-handed pitcher, and he was pretty good. So he decided he wanted to try to get into the military academy because that was located in Caracas, the capital, and that's where the baseball scouts were. So he goes up there, he gets in, and it was really kind of the West Point of Venezuela. And he gets in, but within a few months, he actually falls in love with being a soldier, and the dreams of becoming a big league baseball player really kind of begin to fade.
That's an amazing story, though. It was baseball that got him into the military academy, right? He flunked, physics, and had to hit a ball to get his way into.
That's right. He had flunked one of his classes in high school, and the only way he'd be admitted was if he showed that he had real talent as an athlete. So he tried out for their baseball team. He made it, and that's really how he got into the academy. And he had a good tryout that day. Arguably, if he had had a bad tryout that day, he never would have gotten into the academy and never would have become president of Venezuela.
It's rather amazing how history depends on such little things sometimes. People think of the military, in Latin America especially, as the place where the likes of General Pinochet emerge to oppress and kill people. That's not the case necessarily in Venezuela. So tell us about some of the politics of the Venezuelan military that surrounded Chavez.
Yeah, the Venezuelan military is really quite different from the military in Chile or a place like Argentina, where many of the elites kind of went into the military. In Venezuela, many of them came from the lower classes, very poor people like Chavez, growing up in mud huts. So that was one aspect of the military, and also when they got into it, the year Chavez entered, they actually started a new program, a very progressive program in which they were exposed to the liberal arts. These guys were studying history and philosophy, political science, medicine, and things like that. So Chavez had a very different formation as a soldier than in a place like Chile, and, you know, really grew up in an era when there was not a lot of interest in going to the U.S. School of the Americas and places like that.
And curiously enough, even here at West Point, Noam Chomsky was invited to speak there, I think, last year, and was actually rather warmly received, which is, Noam told me it was a better reception than he ever got at Harvard Yard. So there's some complexities to the military that may not be visible on first glance. Now, there's a phrase that came up in Richard Gott's book on Chavez, which really struck out, stuck me, which was a Harvard-trained colonel of Trotskyist leanings. And I believe that man shows up in your book, too. So the military was actually full of, or not necessarily full of, but there were actually Reds in the military, weren't there?
Well, there really were. It's the Venezuelan military. It's an amazing story. And Chavez is, he actually formed a conspiracy within the military for 10 years. The fellow you're talking about is William Izarra. And he actually, hatched his plot for revolution in Venezuela while studying at Harvard. The military sent him up there for a year to do some research, and he kind of came up with this socialist plan that he wanted to bring back to Venezuela and really kind of overthrow the government and implement this socialist plan. So the Venezuelan military is full of all kinds of surprises that really go against the trend in most of Latin America.
Now, from a very early time, Chavez showed a considerable intelligence and charisma, right? He was kind of guy who won people over pretty easily, wasn't he?
Well, he really was. He's a very charismatic guy. Even his opponents recognized that. And as he began to form this conspiracy in the military in the early 1980s, he could very easily recruit people. He was recruiting other cadets at the academy where he was actually sent back there to give classes. The military had no idea this guy was conspiring. He recruited intellectual leftist former guerrillas like Douglas Bravo. So he was a very bright and charismatic guy, tremendous reader. He says he's addicted to books. He can't stand to be without a book, and built this incredibly large secret clandestine cell in the military, which went on for 10 years.
Yeah, it annoys me, the caricatures you hear of him in the U.S., but I guess also among Latin American elites, that this guy is just a tin pot clown, a dictator. And, in fact, he's a very serious and very substantial character.
Well, he really is. And, part of what I'm trying to do in this book is present a balanced portrait of Chavez. He certainly has his critics, and they should be heard. But you don't really hear the other side of the story with Chavez in the U.S. media. And I was a member of the media down in Venezuela. I was a correspondent for the Associated Press, so I kind of knew this from the inside out. You're not really hearing the other side of the story in which, most of the population in Venezuela actually supports Hugo Chavez. He was just reelected in a clean election last December by 2/3 of the vote. So these poor masses down there really idolize Chavez. They think he's great. The rich elites despise him, but you're not getting that kind of balanced portrait, I don't think, very much in the U.S. media sometimes here.
Now, this isn't in your book, but let's take a little detour. Let's talk about how the foreign press does its work in a place like Venezuela. Who do the correspondents of the mainstream newspapers and broadcast agencies talk to? Where do they get their picture of what's going on in a place like Venezuela?
Right, yeah, and that actually is in my book. I actually later on talk about the U.S., the general media treatment of Chavez and how they operate. And really one of the things that I point out is that many of these journalists, they'll either do one of two things. They'll parachute into the country, what they call parachute in for a few days, stay at a five-star hotel, and that's really kind of like the lens through which they view Venezuela. That's one thing. Or they live in these very upscale neighborhoods often and, are really rubbing elbows with the elites and the upper class. Not quite as much with the lower classes in the barrios and poor neighborhoods. So I think at times it really affects the coverage, and I think it's partly explains why, some of them really may not understand the Chavez phenomenon very well, just viewing it through the eyeglasses of the elites mainly.
And do they, how many speak Spanish? Are they able to go and talk to ordinary folks?
Well, I think it varies. Some can, and I've heard of others that actually need translators, which, makes it difficult as well. And
Spanish is not exactly an obscure language in this hemisphere either.
No, it really isn't. And any correspondent down there, I think, really ought to be able to speak Spanish as a kind of basic requirement. So, that's some of the things going on, the language at times. But even larger than that is just the perspective, I think, that's brought sometimes and the lack of contact with the people that really make up Chavez's support base. Not that these journalists should be propaganda agents for Chavez, obviously not, but they ought to tell both sides of the story in a fair and balanced way. That doesn't really seem to be happening in some cases, and he's actually now has this international image of this, you know, kind of evil monster and evil dictator, which is just simply not the way most people in Venezuela who actually live there view the guy.
I'm speaking with Bart Jones, who is author of Hugo, the Hugo Chavez story from Mud Hut to Perpetual Revolution, published by Steerforth Press. And let's talk about go back to the trajectory of Hugo Chavez. Throughout the 80s, he's plotting this coup, which, what, 1992 that came to be?
Yeah, he's not really plotting the coup from 92, or, you know, as early as the 80s, but he is organizing this conspiracy. And it's originally just devoted to studying the teachings of Simón Bolívar, who was kind of the George Washington of much of Latin America. And he's very disgusted by the social injustice of the country. You know, you have all this oil wealth down there, but it's mainly concentrated in the hands of a few people, you know, this kind of very rich ruling elite. Meanwhile, you've got these huge masses of poor people, none of that oil wealth is trickling down to them. So there's real anger among these lower classes. And there's also tremendous corruption in the country. You know, some of them would say that, you know, the elites there kind of raped and pillaged the place for a number of decades. So Chavez is part of that lower class. He shares that anger toward the social injustice, and that's really what causes him to form this secret conspiracy in the military to kind of fight the social injustice in his country. That goes on for 10 years. In 1989, we have this social uprising, the Caracaso food riots, in which the Venezuelan government implements an IMF, you know, economic shock program. Prices skyrocket. People take to the streets to protest and loot stores. And the president, Carlos Andrés Pérez, sends the military into the streets basically to mow down the people. So you have this massacre. It's one of the largest massacres in modern Latin American history. Many people simply shot in their homes, you know, well after all the looting had finished. So Chavez is, you know, and his people are doubly enraged by this Caracaso uprising and the massacre. And by 92, he launches his own, you know, famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, his own coup aimed at overthrowing Carlos Andrés Pérez.
And what happened?
Well, the coup fails militarily, but politically Chavez becomes a big hero. You know, it may be hard for Americans to understand, but most people in the country cheer the guy on. They think it's great that he's tried to overthrow Carlos Andrés Pérez, even though Pérez is actually elected in a free vote.
Well, but the freedom of election was fairly limited in those days. Wasn't the parties kind of rigged the system to guarantee a pretty limited range of options, didn't they?
Well, there were. I mean, there were two kind of traditional parties that represented the elites mainly, and they controlled the system for decades. So, yes, to the poor masses of Venezuela, it was a phony democracy. It was not a real democracy. It was a democracy, you know, arranged to benefit this elite ruling class. So, you know, they had no love for Carlos Andrés Pérez, even though he was elected.
And so he spends 2 years in jail and actually learned a lot in jail, right?
Yes, you know, the jail time is, you know, obviously a period of a lot of reflection, a lot of reading, consolidating his thoughts about what he wanted to do with the country as much as he could. He meets with a lot of leftist intellectuals, academics, former guerrilla leaders like Douglas Bravo, and they begin to kind of form or solidify his Bolivarian movement a little bit more.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that he had so much communication with fellow prisoners and the outside world, because if he'd done that in the United States, he would have spent the rest of his life in a soundproof white room. So this is not quite as brutal a regime, even though it was worthy of a revolution.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, they allowed visitors in, and the visitors would, you know, sneak messages in, and they would roll up little pieces of paper and stick them in their socks or stick them in their pens. Journalists would actually have tape recorders smuggled into the prison, and Chavez would tape interviews and then send them out, and they would play them on public buses. So, you know, there was a little bit of a porous situation there with him in the jail.
So let's fast forward to later in the decade when he actually wins election as president. And he's been elected, reelected, survived a recall, got a constitutional referendum. So this guy has really met the test of open elections. He's not the tin pot dictator of legend, is he?
Well, you know, I think that's true. And again, this image of Chavez as an evil dictator, you know, you've got to recognize, I think if you're going to be fair about it, he really has been democratically elected in Venezuela. He's won something like 12 elections since 98, including congressional elections and referendums, you know, where his side won. So he is being voted in by the majority of the Venezuelan people. Again, we're not hearing their voice as much as this loud and, you know, well-connected and affluent minority who really oppose him. And, you know, you're just not always kind of getting both sides of the story. But he is democratically elected. I tell people, just walk on the streets in Venezuela if you don't believe this and talk to the people. You'll see that he's got a lot of support. Also has a very vocal, you know, opposition, but the majority support the guy.
Yeah, I believe you quote some editorial from the Daily News that said the opposition just gets jailed and shot, which is a complete fabrication.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Some of the statements, I mean, Chavez has become, you know, kind of one of the world's favorite punching bags, you know, verbal punching bags. Anybody can say almost anything they want about the guy, and it doesn't really matter if it's connected to reality or facts. And it's not to say he can't be criticized on certain issues like corruption. He certainly can be. He hasn't done enough to crack down on that. But, you know, there's some of these kind of exaggerations and simply false statements about, I mean, the opposition goes on television in Venezuela and calls him a dictator, and nothing really happens to them. So to call this a dictatorship, you know, would seem to be a little bit contradictory.
Well, now let's talk about his agenda. I mean, the phrase he coined is 21st century socialism. What does he mean by that exactly?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I don't know if even he knows exactly what the 21st century socialism is. It's an evolving concept. He obviously wants to introduce elements of socialism into his country. He feels that the kind of, you know, IMF, neoliberal free market program has basically failed Venezuela and failed Latin America. It has not lifted the masses out of poverty. That seems to be pretty obvious. So he wants to try a different route. And he's beginning to implement that in a variety of ways. You know, they've nationalized some key strategic industries down there. And, you know, overall what he's doing so far is basically redirecting all this oil wealth to the poor masses. You know, that's the general thrust of it.
And we should point out that he had a lot to do with whipping up some militancy in OPEC, didn't he?
Well, absolutely. When Chavez came into office, OPEC was, you know, almost moribund. Chavez really brought all of the leaders of OPEC together in Venezuela for a big OPEC meeting in the year 2000. I think it was the first kind of summit within 25 years. So he revitalized that organization, and, you know, oil prices have really gone up quite a bit since then.
They just set an all-time high today in the New York Mercantile Exchange.
That's exactly right. So Chavez certainly played a role in revitalizing OPEC, and that's been to the benefit of their countries, even though folks here might not like the higher prices they see at the oil pump.
Well, it's also too bad the Saudi royal family is getting some of that booty, too. But so what is Chavez doing with that oil money? You've got these... You write about these social programs, educational and health programs. Give us some idea of what that's all about.
Right. Well, you know, this is kind of the core of what he's doing down there. He's pumping, you know, billions of dollars into the poor neighborhoods, into the barrios down there, mainly through educational and health programs. You know, they have taught over a million illiterate people to read and write. And I've witnessed these programs. I've been down there. And I got to tell you, you know, you can't help but be affected when you sit there and watch some 70-year-old lady, you know, learn to spell her name for the first time and read a few words. So he's doing things like that, and he's also pumping money into health programs. They actually have Cuban doctors living in barrios throughout the country now. This is really just unbelievable to the residents of these communities. These doctors live in small clinics on the second floor, provide health services on the first floor 24 hours a day. I mean, most Venezuelan doctors would never even set foot into a barrio for an hour. You know, much less move in there and provide services. So these are the types of things that are making Chavez very popular down there among the poor masses, and it's pretty logical why his popularity ratings are fairly high.
You did mention that he's nationalized a couple of companies. Of course, the oil company, PDVSA, was long in state hands, but he's tried to put that under, as a state within a state, kind of an autonomous zone. He's trying to rein that in. And the telecommunications company, but there really hasn't been a wholesale nationalization of property, has there?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, what Chavez has done so far is really quite a bit different from Castro. I know a lot of people, you know, compare the two and say Chavez is becoming another Castro, but Chavez has not taken over the entire economy the way Castro did. You know, and folks in Venezuela can go out on the streets and protest against Chavez. They do this all the time. You know, as I said, they go on TV and call him a dictator, and a real dictatorship, I think, would be lined up against the wall and shot for that. So there are some clear differences, you know, on the economic front, on the political freedoms front. Is Chavez going to turn into another Castro? Hey, who knows? Maybe he will. But so far, at least, you know, looking at the facts, there are some pretty clear differences.
Well, the things that people point to when they do forecast that evolution, first of all, shutting down that TV station. What's the story of that?
Well, you know, it's a good question, Doug. And obviously, anytime a TV station gets shut down, it's cause to pay attention. However, this is a little bit more complicated than saying it's simply crushing free speech. This television station took part in a coup against Chavez in the year 2000. So I think the question there is, you know, what would happen here in the U.S. if ABC, CBS, NBC, or CNN took part in a coup against President Bush? I think they'd probably be shut down in about 5 minutes by the FCC, and their owners would be thrown in jail. In Venezuela, the station was actually allowed to continue operating for 5 years. When its license came up for renewal, the government said, you know, we are not going to renew this license. So this is really a station that was not just criticizing a democratically elected president, but was trying to topple one, and that's a pretty big difference, I think.
And what about the other media? Have there been moves against other broadcaster, print, or electronic media?
Well, not really. I mean, as I say, people go on TV and call Hugo Chavez a dictator. So that sounds like kind of freedom of expression to me. You know, are there clashes between Chavez and the media? Sure. You know, some of his supporters have roughed up some opposition journalists in the streets, and that's to be condemned, obviously. So there are certainly tensions. But, you know, overall, the media down there probably gets away with a lot more than they could ever get away with here in the U.S.
And another thing that people point to is he created a single party, which I guess a lot of people think you know, is the road to Bolshevism. What's that about?
Well, you know, another misconception, I think. He's not eliminating opposition parties by any means. They are free to organize and do whatever they like. What he's trying to do is unify all of his parties, all the parties that support him. You know, there were 20 or 30 parties out there that supported him. He wants to bring them all together and try to unify them. But the opposition is completely free to organize, and they do that, and they can oppose him. They can go in the streets and protest against him. They can go on television. So, you know, he's not, again, creating a kind of Cuban situation where there's only one party in the whole country.
He does, however, talk to Fidel a lot, right? They're quite close.
Absolutely. He talks to Fidel Castro a lot. You know, they are buddies. That leads to a lot of speculation that he, you know, may turn into another Castro. So I think he admires things, certain things about Castro, their health and education programs, you know, standing up to the U.S. And that type of thing. But as I say, I think there are some real differences, at least in what he's done to date, that really separate him from Castro.
And finally, you interviewed him for several hours for this book. What was it like?
Well, you know, it was late at night for one thing. He's a night owl, so the one interview was from 11:10 at night to 1:30 in the morning. I was with him on the presidential plane in the presidential palace. He even gave me a ride in his car up from the airport. So I had about 4 hours of access to him for the book and for the interviews. And, you know, he's a very, when you meet him, he's very charismatic and a down-to-earth kind of guy. You know, he's allergic to protocol. He's the opposite of your kind of stuffed shirt politician. He says what's ever on his mind, whether he's, you know, sitting with you or in front of 50,000 people, and sometimes that gets him in trouble as well. But you know, he really just speaks what he thinks.
Did he monologue, or did you have a back and forth?
Oh, no, we had a back and forth. You know, this was not a three-hour speech by him by any means. He just said, go ahead, ask what you want. And I fired question after question at him, and he didn't answer in half-hour responses. You know, it was certainly reasonable, and I was able to cover a lot of ground with him.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, and good luck with the book. I've been speaking with Bart Jones, who is a reporter for Newsday, but also, more importantly, the author of Hugo, the Hugo Chavez story from Mud Hut to Perpetual Revolution, just published by Steerforth Press.
Thanks, Doug. I just wanted to mention it's Hugo in big white letters on the cover, just so they don't mix it up with other books.
Yes, and red letters on the spine, if you're looking at it in a bookstore.
That's right.
All right. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back in a little bit.
WBAI, we're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is WBAI, not only on 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And please do visit the website. We've got archives of all the programming and lots of news and info, so please update it frequently, so check it out. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk Iran with Ervind Abrahamian. Thank you. was a reprise of that Beethoven piano sonata number 27, performed by Alfred Brendel. I put the tracks in the CD in the wrong order, so we heard that again. But that's all right. It's a very beautiful piece of music. And now, an interview I recorded the other day with Irvin Abrahamian, who is a professor at Baruch College, and I decided to give him a call because last week, the former president of Iran, Rafsanjani, was elected to the Assembly of Experts, which is a clerical body that selects the nation's supreme leader, which is a very strange title, but that is a religious body, a religious office that is the supreme power in Iran's strange mix of theocracy and democracy. Ervin Abrahamian has written many books about Iran and is a native of that country, although he's an ethnic Armenian. He would be I thought he was the perfect guy to ask what's going on, not only with Rafsanjani's election, but with politics in that complicated and fascinating country. So here it is, Ervin Abrahamian.
We heard that Rafsanjani was elected to head the Assembly of Experts last week. The structure of the Iranian government is a bit complex. Could you give us the idea of how the Assembly of Experts fits into this complicated structure?
Yes, it's actually very important. It's sort of second chamber because it elects the supreme leader and in theory can remove the supreme leader for incompetence, or if it decides the supreme leader's health isn't good enough, and it can it actually meets at least once a year and has that power over the supreme leader. The members of the Assembly of Experts are elected by the general public. So it's a sort of a, you could say, indirect election of the supreme leader. Often in the West, the supreme leader is described as an unelected leader, but in fact he is elected indirectly. The problem with the elections for the Assembly of Experts is that it's pretty tightly controlled. The Guardian Council, which is predominantly clerical, vets people, the candidates for the assembly, and the assembly itself gives an exam for the candidates, presumably to make sure that they know enough Islamic theology to be able to be elected.
Who is the supreme leader, and how does that office relate to that of the president?
Well, the supreme leader has overall supervisory power over all the branches of the government. So the government has three branches, executive, legislative, and judiciary, but the supreme leader is arches above that. And in theory, the supreme leader can dismiss the president. The supreme leader also appoints half the members of the Guardian Council, which is the equivalent to the Supreme Court in the United States.
And the supreme leader now is Khamenei?
It's Khamenei, yes.
Sorry, my Farsi is not up to snuff.
He also has the important role of he can appoint the leaders of the various military branches. So that the armed force is actually not under the control of the president, but under the supreme leader.
All this it seems like a complicated way of dealing with the mix of theocracy and democracy that characterizes the state since the 1979 revolution. Is that right?
You put it very nicely. Yes, it is. It is a sort of a mishmash of theocracy and democracy. The democratic aspects are that there are elections for the president, for parliament, and for the Assembly of Experts, but the clerical leaders have these sort of supervisory powers to make sure that the elected officials don't do things that would go against what they say, against the Constitution or against the Islamic law.
How do we balance out these influences? Do they go through phases in which one gets the upper hand? And we have this image in the West of reformists versus fundamentalists, and the sense that one gains the upper hand for a few years and then the other gains the upper hand. What's the reality behind that caricature?
Well, under Khomeini after the revolution, because he had this charismatic role, no one could really contradict or run against him. I mean, he was really the supreme leader in the full sense. But when he died, there was really no one to fit his shoes. And Khamenei, who replaced him as the supreme leader, just doesn't have his charismatic aura. So the position has a lot of power, but the person of Khamenei doesn't have that weight that Khomeini did. Now, where the struggle between reformers and conservatives comes is in the electoral sphere, especially for the elections for president or parliament. And there you do have real competition, and issues are very important. And there it's, the electorate actually is very complex, because what we would call the core of the conservatives, one would say the hardcore of the fundamentalist electorate, is no more than about 20-25%, actually less than the evangelical core in the United States. And so the conservatives would never be able to win elections with just the limited core of 25%. So to win, they have to reach out to independents, and they also have to, in a way, split the reformers. And they also use the issue of national security, especially after the Axis of Evil speech by President Bush, to be able to win over people who are not really hardcore fundamentalists.
Now, it's said that there are reports that the culture ministry seized copies of Rafsanjani's 1984 memoir because it quoted Khomeini as expressing regret over the "Death to America" slogan. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think this is a sort of ongoing struggle about legacy. Khomeini actually was very complex. At some times he supported the conservatives, sometimes the reformers. So both can actually use his legacy and try to take the mantle of Khomeini. And here, in other cases, what Rafsanjani is doing is trying to point out that actually Khomeini was not a narrow-minded, a hardliner. Often he was quite pragmatic, one could even say, in less polite terms, opportunistic, especially when it came to foreign policy. Of course, the famous case is the Iran-Contra case, where Khomeini dealt with President Reagan and bought arms, and his representatives directly negotiated with the United States.
And Rafsanjani was deeply involved with that, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. But he could not have done that without the okay of Khomeini.
There are reports now with his Rafsanjani's election to head the Assembly of Experts. The interpretation was that this is a sign that the reformers are once again coming out on top of the Iranian power play. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't say it's that simple, because actually, while this is happening, that Rafsanjani has strengthened his position there, what you see at the same time happening is Ahmadinejad, the president, is strengthening his hold over the Ministry of Oil. And since that brings in so much of the revenue, that's a very important issue. But while this is going on, actually, the supreme leader has shuffled some of the army commanders and the military leaders, and there probably he is appointing much more his people he can trust in those positions. And they're beholden to the supreme leader, not to either Rafsanjani or to the president.
Rafsanjani has a long resume in the government. He was president for 7 or 8 years. He's a very rich man himself. So where is he coming from, and what's his political base, his political predilections?
Well, his base now is that he's a veteran politician who knows how to deal with foreign powers, that he is shrewd, and he is down to earth. So he is actually appealing, you can say, to the more pragmatic people in Iran about how to deal with the United States, especially over the issue of nuclear weapons and Israel. But this can also be a disadvantage because by his aura is that of a sort of a shrewd veteran politician. He also comes across as manipulative, elitist, and the fact that he is quite wealthy. I think his wealth has been exaggerated, but because he's wealthy, he's then considered not a man of the people, not a man who can speak for the downtrodden, which was always the supposedly the core of the revolution.
It's said, though, that he might want to pull back from the confrontation with the United States to some degree over the nuclear program. How strong are the forces in Iran that are interested in reaching some kind of accommodation with the U.S. rather than turning up the temperature?
I think there are the dominant, actually, forces are in favor of cooling relations. And the statements that Ahmadinejad has made are actually counter, I think, the dominant voices. So it's not only Rafsanjani. The supreme leader has been also very cautious on this. So have most of the military leaders. So has the former president, Khatami. And as far as actually the nuclear program has progressed, it's been very cautious. They haven't done anything erratic, and they've kept on very good terms with the UN International Atomic Energy Group and have actually met much of the requirements of Al-Baradei from the International Atomic Energy. So there they've been actually haven't tried to rock the boat. It's been the United States that's actually been more confrontational on that issue.
Yeah, it would seem that, the U.S. behavior is almost a gift to the hardest of hardliners.
Yes, I think that also the policy here, especially from Vice President's office in Washington, is to basically incite Iran to do something rash, i.e. he's giving fuel for people like Ahmadinejad to do something rash, so then the U.S. can depict Iran as the aggressor. And so far, the Iranian leadership has not fallen for the trap. They've kept their cool, even when their diplomats have been arrested in Iraq, when they've been accused of all sorts of things. So far, actually, they've been very reasonable and cool-headed. They've bent backwards to work with the United Nations. And I think this must be causing a lot of frustration in the Vice President's office because they would like Iran to do something rash.
I'm sure the example of Iraq must not be far from their minds, that even if you cooperate, that doesn't necessarily win the goodwill of Washington.
No, and I think they know that. They're more, I think they're the cooler heads are interested more in keeping on better side of the UN and the Europeans. In that way, they hope that they could place a restraint on Washington.
Earlier you said that Rafsanjani is not perceived as speaking for the downtrodden and the poor. Of course, Ahmadinejad was elected a couple of years ago precisely for speaking on their behalf. He made a lot of populist economic promises. Doesn't seem like he's really delivered on them. What's happened?
Well, he's been spending money, oil money, but what that has done has caused inflation. The net result has been, in fact, people on the lower economic ladder have suffered considerably from that. So he is in a bind there because it's, first of all, it's easy to promise all sorts of goodies to the population. It's not that easy to deliver unless you actually put together economic programs. And to do that, he needs to liberalize the economy to some extent. He know, needs to attract foreign capital. And those things are very hard to do as long as there is this sort of mood of crisis between Iran and United States.
There's also a new labor law and a private, which makes it easier to fire people, and a privatization program underway. What's going on with that side of economic policy?
Some conservatives claim that the labor law, because it gives job security to people in factories, this is an obstacle to attracting foreign capital. I don't think that's the real issue. I think the real issue is the international sort of atmosphere that deters foreign capital from moving into Iran. Even in the best days of the Shah, there wasn't actually much foreign capital going to Iran. You really need a change in the whole international atmosphere to be able to attract foreign capital, and that I don't see in the books.
Well, aside from the oil sector, what would be an attractive target for foreign capital?
Mostly it would be consumer goods, but the Iranian capital does a fairly good job there. You could develop much more the oil industry. In fact, Iran drastically needs refineries.
Yeah, they have to import refined products. Right?
Yeah, and Iran, the oil industry itself would need capital to boost up oil production, but especially refined oil, petroleum.
What are sanctions doing to the economy?
Well, the main thing that's doing is deterring foreign capital, especially European oil companies who would have been interested in investing in oil. They've been scared off by that. And the scariest side from their point of view is that if they do invest in Iran, they can be penalized in the United States, and they don't want to face that risk.
It's said that Rafsanjani is interested in pursuing a kind of Chinese model of development, meaning political centralization, openness to foreign investment, and some kind of diplomatic pragmatism. Do you see that on his agenda?
No, I don't. The situation is very different. I know they use that example, and they may even think in those terms, but in practical terms, I don't think the Iranian regime could do what Chinese communists did, which was basically dump a huge labor force into a free market economy with no social supports. That would cause so much political disruptions inside the country. I don't think the regime would want to risk that. The communist regime was much more powerful in that. It could do that, especially after Tiananmen. But I don't think the Iranian regime would want to risk doing that. After all, the main appeal, the main legitimacy of the Islamic Republic is that it supposedly represents the poor, the downtrodden, and to throw them into the marketplace without any safety net, it would be suicidal for the regime.
You've written on how Khomeini was very ingenious at crafting kind of populist economic rhetoric that sounded redistributionist but didn't really want to mess with property relations. Is that still kind of a dominant economic model in Iran?
Yes. In fact, I would say still the bazaar, which is small business, is quite secure, and the regime doesn't really threaten that. And the elements of the bazaar that are linked to the regime, they're the people who do best economically. They get the contracts. They have the advantages in import-export. So the bazaar as a whole is done quite well economically.
The broad state of the economy is not so good. There's high levels of unemployment, high and rising inflation, some discontent among the urban masses. How stable is the regime?
Well, I think the discontent or the economic problems are often exaggerated. It would be nice to have a jumpstart economy with foreign capital, but it's not a dire situation. Oh, in the last 10 years, actually, the oil revenue has been used quite well in bringing benefits to both urban and rural poor. So you've had electrification, you've had a lot of road building, you've had bringing of pipe water to the villages, medical facilities to the villages, schools to the villages. So these are all social services that have benefited the vast majority of people. So they're actually, I think the average Iranian is better off now than 10 years ago. So it's not as if things are getting worse and worse and the pressure is building up. It's going to explode. I think the problems are that people still expect benefits, and they were hoping that Rafsanjani would somehow bring far more direct economic benefits to the poor besides the social services.
And then what about on the side of social and civil liberties? We've heard about crackdowns on barbers and the crackdowns on music and all kinds of things like that. What's the situation on that side of things, and how does the population feel about it?
Well, I think these are things that fluctuate. There have before been periods where the governments have cracked down on sort of daily habits, on what music you listen to and so on. And people know that these are sort of fads, that they're not going to last. And I think people just holding their breath, expecting sooner or later that the government will relax on those things. And I think the government's shrewd enough that you don't intervene too much in people's private affairs and so on. And here again, reformers can quote Khomeini on issues of privacy and what you do in your home is your private concern. It shouldn't be something that the government should be interfering with. So it's something that I don't think the government's going to push to the extreme that people are going to react strongly.
And then finally, I know this is wild speculation, but what would Iran be like now if the Bush administration hadn't identified it as a member of the Axis of Evil?
Until then, the reformers still had a good chance of, I think, getting reelected. It's true that they probably didn't have the overwhelming support they had in 1997, where something like 70% of the electorate voted for the reformers. Some of that landslide had eroded, mainly because the reformers had failed to bring major economic improvements. But still, there was, I think, majority support for the reformers. The Axis of Evil undercut that because it really said that United States is a threat, and the reformers who were mostly associated with trying to improve relations with the United States, that their foreign policy had not only failed, but it was dangerous because they were sort of dancing with the devil, and the devil was threatening to come to Iran and destroy the whole House of Cards. So that for many people, the Axis of Evil speech basically made the liberals look as people inviting a disaster.
It's a cliche, but it does sound like there's a lot of similarities in the rhetoric on both sides.
Oh, yes, you are. No, I think the neoconservatives here, that especially in those days, are a mirror image of what is now in Iran called principal conservatives. Ahmadinejad considers himself a principalist, i.e. he stands on principles on his conservatism.
And that was the voice of Ervin Dabrahamian, who is a professor at Baruch College and author of several books on Iran, and I recorded an interview with him just the other day. So, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and let's go out with this piece of music, new from the Wombats. Let's dance to Joy Division, our traditional proto-weekend dancey close. Till next week. Bye.